Welcome to Current State. I'm Mickey Hurton, associate publisher of Lansing City Pulse, filling in for Mark Bayshore, who is still on vacation, but will return, no doubt. Hey, we've got a great show lined up today. Lansing State Journal watchdog reporter Steve Reed joins me in a few minutes for the latest on the development project at Lansing Township's lands north of Eastwood Town Center. Plus, we'll talk to the CEO of the Michigan Retailers Association and local business owner about the I Buy Nearby program. And we'll also hear another installment from our most recent pop-up story series. And it was a tragic weekend in the world of sports. We'll check with current sports host Al Martin on the death of former U.S. MSU Spartan Mylan Hicks and Miami Marlin pitcher Jose Fernandez. And we'll toast golf legend Arnold Palmer, who passed away at the age of 87. All that coming up on Current State. But first, Steve Reed. Hey, thanks for being here, Steve. Steve has been with the Lansing State Journal since February 2012, and he spent the last 18 months looking into Lansing Township's much-delayed development of property north of the Eastwood Town Center and the huge financial strain that's put on this small part of our community. Steve, this was not an easy project, I wouldn't think, because it's pretty complicated. But, you know, tell us first about Eastwood Town Center, because I think most people think of it as the shopping center.
Sure, and Mickey, thanks.
There's more to it than that.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I think most people in the capital area think of Eastwood as the area in the northwest corner of US 127 and Lake Lansing Road. There are about 200 acres there, and the center, 30 acres, is Eastwood Town Center. The remaining roughly 160 to 165 acres were assembled by Mike Ide. And the project that I've been looking into is the Heights at Eastwood, which is approximately 14 acres of the 165 that Mike Ide has leased to Lansing Township's Downtown Development Authority for an economic development project.
Now, when people go up there, they go to the movies, and this is sort of what's in back of that, isn't it?
Right. On the north side of the cinema, there has been constructed over the last 5 years a Hyatt Hotel, some luxury apartments owned by DTN, a parking ramp, and most recently another hotel, Fairfield Hotel.
Now, why all of this development there? What was the point and the goal?
Well, the township fell on hard times when the General Motors plants, it had two General Motors plants, and they closed, and they had success with Eastwood Town Center. It was generating a lot of tax revenue, and they wanted to build on that. In 2005, there was a economic development study that suggested creating a pretty diverse a neighborhood north of Eastwood Town Center. Their goal is to build taxable property to expand the tax base.
So they really became the developers in a sense.
Right. Mr. Ide owned the land. The Downtown Development Authority signed a 99-year lease for the DDA to develop the project on about 14 acres.
Now, this was always a stretch, though, wasn't it? I mean, because Lansing Township is relatively small, and that they went into some took on significant debt to make this happen.
Well, the project, when it was talked about between 2005 and 2010, the price tag started around $10 million. The next time a figure was discussed, it was $14 million. And by the time they voted, the Downtown Development Authority Board voted to incur long-term debt, they were borrowing $22 million. They're borrowing $22 million by selling $22 million worth of long-term bonds.
And that, in theory, I mean, based on the initial plan and the ideas that this would be a popular development and easily leased, would have covered probably what the basic expenses and repayment. It would have been enough money to do the job, but
right.
It didn't work out that way. Though,
right. Well,
it?
The financial projections said that the town center would be operating, I'm sorry, the heights at Eastwood would be complete and operating within a couple of years. The bonds were sold in late 2010, so the town center, the Heights project was expected to be underway, not underway, but open for business sometime in 2012. And it was, according to the financial projections, going to be profitable, become profitable in 2013. And basically, it was going to be a relatively straightforward project that was going to be so popular, it would be paying for itself quickly, and none of that happened.
So where is it today? What's the status? Because, you know, we've had problems. I mean, you know, we're still coming out of the Great Recession. There's shortages of workers. I mean, there's lots of things that affect the construction industry, and even the retail industry. So what do we have there now?
Well, we have a project that is complete as it was initially envisioned, in that there is a Hyatt Hotel that is connected to a parking ramp that is connected to luxury apartments. Across the street from the front door of the Hyatt, there's an approximately 11-square-foot building that houses a steakhouse, a wine bar, and a pizza restaurant. The problem that has developed at the Heights at Eastwood is it was always going to pay for itself based on leasing out about 88,000 square feet of commercial retail space. Mm-hmm. Under the parking garage, under the apartment building, and then the 11,000 square foot building. The available space has remained largely vacant, so it has never generated the rental income that was anticipated, and that is what has really complicated the situation.
Well, now this is really difficult for the township because it really doesn't have deep pockets. So how does it deal with that? I mean, it thought it would get all this revenue to cover its costs. It went out and sold bonds. What has it done to, you know, well, deal with this shortfall?
Well, let me explain it this way. When the project was delayed, and it was delayed for a variety of reasons, everything that could go wrong seemed to go wrong. And so the income wasn't coming in from leasing out the space. So the DDA asked Mr. Ide, and on behalf of his LLC, if they would delay the first ground lease payment. The initial ground lease payments in the 99-year lease are about $1 million a year. So the 2012 and 2013 payments were delayed, and then it got to be the end of 2013, and the DDA's executive director, Steve Hayward, asked Mr. Ide if they could defer the 2014 ground lease payment as well.
So essentially, they've cut new deals with the owner of the land there.
Well, this deferral of ground lease payments couldn't go on forever, mm-hmm. and here we are nearing the end of 2016 with the retail space still empty, so something had to change.
Well, now I understand, though, it's part of these deals to sort of, you know, bridge over the losses and things until they can get this up and going. They've also given part of the project back to Mike Ide, right? I mean, initially, he had no ownership, and now gradually his nose is put into the tent, and he's gaining ownership of this property.
Right. That's what the change was, is that when the DDA couldn't make $1 million ground lease payment, Mr. Ide took an equivalent amount of equity in the project. And that agreement, and they reached an agreement to structure this, and his ownership stake is capped at 20%. But unless the project leases out its space, the Heights is going to continue to have problems. And, of course, the problems reflect carry over to the township. The township has backed the first 20 $2 million in bonds with its full faith and credit. There hasn't been a missed bond a payment, but there hasn't been enough income from the project to pay operational costs, bond payments, and ground lease rent.
I mean, in the long run, isn't the plan for the township to sell off this project? I mean, they wanted the economic development. They want the taxes. I'm not sure they really want to be the owners of this and sell this to, well, whomever is a good buyer. Isn't that a strategy?
Right. That is the exit strategy. The bonds can't be retired before 7 years. They're 30-year bonds, and the bond buyers expect to receive interest for at least 7 years. And Mr. Hayward has developed an exit strategy, and I'm sure he hasn't developed it by himself, but he's the one who explained it to me. And they plan to sell the project as quickly as they are able to pay off the bonds early, and that's 2020.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting in the article that you wrote in the newspaper, and it was a long investigative series, I mean, really quite good. The intent from Lansing Township seemed to be that Mike Ide and other developers up there might be interested in this property, but they don't seem quite so sure. Now, whether it's a negotiating tactic or not, doesn't seem like they're particularly interested in picking up these developments.
Well, as Mr. Hayward explained it to me, the two leading prospects for buying the Heights project are Retail Properties of America, who are the owners of Eastwood Town Center, and Mr. Ide. And he believed that Mr. Ide was the more logical and more likely buyer.
Right.
And so I contacted Mr. Ide, and he said he liked his position. He wasn't interested in buying what he said he already owns.
And then you also had another developer. I mean, right? The other companies also don't have any particular interest in this.
I contacted RPAI in their Chicago area offices, and they said that they are buying. Their business is operating shopping centers across the United States, and they are buying, but they've got a plan, and they're active in 10 markets, and Michigan is not one of those 10 markets, and they said they have no interest at this time in buying the Heights at Eastwood.
And after spending all this time looking at this project, I mean, do you have a sense of how it's likely to unfold? I mean, there's a lot of loose ends and assumptions still going into the success of this. Where do you think it goes, or do any sense of where it goes?
I don't know where it goes. I think that's what the township and the DDA boards have to figure out. They could ease the strain if they would lease out the vacant space, commercial and retail space under the parking ramp and under the apartments. If they filled the space, then the project could be mm-hmm. paying its own way. But here we are near the end of 2016, and the retail and commercial space has never been even 30% occupied. That has to change if they're going to keep going in their ownership.
You know, what I found interesting in your series was that when they conceived this project, that there was hardly agreement from the DDA board members on whether this was a good idea or whether it wasn't. And some of the really experienced business leaders on the DDA board were really worried about it. I mean, they were quite cautious, and with their business experience suggested that perhaps, you know, it was a bit optimistic.
There were experienced business people on the DDA board who thought that the DDA got in too big a rush to commit to long-term debt. And they raised issues such as, what if the retail space doesn't rent? What if there are delays caused by disputes over easements and covenants? Those disputes did arise. They delayed the project by about 9 months. The space hasn't rented. That has created a virtual crisis for it. So it was all foreseen, but the project went ahead anyhow.
Well, we'll have to see how that unfolds and how the township deals with it. I want to switch gears here for a second. And Steve, before he came to Lansing as a reporter, was the editor of the paper in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, weren't you?
I was.
And we, as we heard on the news today, the serious flooding there, which comes as, I guess, no surprise to you.
Right. And actually, let's set the record straight. I was an editor at, and reporter at the Cedar Rapids paper. Cedar Rapids experienced a devastating flood in 2008, and they knew they had to do something. I think it was the 500-year flood. And here it comes again. If you're watching the news, you can see that there's a massive sandbag operation and evacuations have been ordered.
Did you, well, was there flooding while you were there?
No.
Were the community still trying to deal with flooding issues? I mean, what did they do to try to mitigate the damage?
Mitigating for flooding is an expensive proposition, and the money has to come from somewhere, and there has to be agreement on what's going to change, what areas and neighborhoods are going to be affected.
What's likely to happen there? Any sense? I mean, is this just a perpetual kind of problem for these river communities?
Well, they're going to go, I think, 5 or 6 feet above flood stage, so it's going to happen all over again, and maybe this will be the time that, in response to the flooding of homes and business areas, they will find the money and commit to a preventative approach.
Really going to take probably a serious financial investment by the federal government to make this sort of thing happen.
It would seem so.
Well, it's always odd when you've been in a community that suffers a tragedy like this. I mean, I've found that myself. I mean, it feels so much more real than just a news story. I mean, you probably knew people there and know the neighborhoods and everything has been flooded out.
We were calling our friends in Cedar Rapids yesterday to see how they're doing.
Yeah, and how are they doing?
They're hoping for the best.
Anyway. Hey, that's a sad story, and I appreciate your views on that. We've been talking with Steve Reed. He's the lead Rochdog reporter for the Lansing State Journal, and we earlier talked about developments in Lansing Township and the sort of the Eastwood property. Steve, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Mickey.
And we'll talk again to you soon.
Thank you.
Take care. Coming up, we'll hear another pop-up story from our August event, where the theme was Call of the Wild. That's later this hour on Current State. We're getting closer and closer to that time of year when most of us will hit retail stores and websites to do our holiday shopping. You know, the Michigan Retailers Association is hoping we'll remember to spend our dollars at local Michigan businesses, and they've created a campaign to encourage us to do so. The Buy Nearby program is a call to action to support and celebrate local businesses and communities. And joining us here in the studio today is CEO of the Michigan Retailers Association, Jim Hallen. Jim, welcome to Current State.
Hey, Mickey, great to be with you. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, so tell us first about the mission of the Retailers Association.
Sure. Michigan Retailers started in 1940. We represent about 15,000 storefronts throughout Michigan, and they could range from the very largest multi-state retailer down to the very smallest seasonal retail operator. In the Lansing area, we're proud to include such members as Kosacek's and Playmakers and Becky Beauchene Kolka and Lynn and Owen Jewelers and Dusty's. And so it's a very, as well as Walgreen and Macy's. So it's a pretty diverse membership.
I mean, I always find that interesting. You go from the very smallest to some of the largest. And I always found it interesting that very often they all compete with one another.
They compete, but retail is retail. And on issues of importance, they agree 99.9% of the time.
So tell us about this campaign. What does it mean, and how does it unfold?
Yeah, we started it 4 years ago, and every year it's grown. And the idea, we call it the I Buy Nearby Weekend. And we talk about it all year long. And it really comes to accumulation on October 1st and 2nd, so this Saturday and Sunday. And we encourage people to think about buying nearby before they go in their den and get on the internet and push the button and send the dollars across state lines. We'd like them to think about supporting retailers who have invested in their community, because your neighbor very well may be employed by a retailer, and it's that retailer that supports the local high school team. So we've developed this concept called the Buy Nearby Program, and we have a mascot called the Buy Nearby Guy. And
he looks just like the state of Michigan.
He
does. Who would have thought?
he does look like the state of Michigan. His hat is the UP.
Right.
And he's like the cutout is a shopping bag. And we hire four interns throughout the summer. And the Buy Nearby Guy goes to local parades and farmers markets and works his way throughout the state. And just it's a fun, friendly campaign. Just to try to remind people that if you invest a dollar in the mitten, that dollar is going to spin many times in the mitten, and it's been very well received.
Have you looked at the economic impact, any multipliers or things like that?
Yeah, about a nickel of every 10 cents recycles in the community, and that can be in future purchases. It can be hiring other employees. The economics, retail-related industry, according to the Michigan Department of Treasury in 2014, represented about $94 billion in economic activity. And we retained the Anderson Economic Group in East Lansing, and their report indicated that just 10% of that economic activity was able to generate in Michigan, that would create an additional 7,400 jobs. So it's not just it's an employment issue. It's allowing retailers to reinvest in the community, and it's a great program.
So you've had this going for a bunch of years. Can you a sense of the impact? I mean, has it worked?
It has. What really gave it was the identity is when we were able to attach the mascot to the program. Just the concept, you know, buying local, a lot of communities do that, and they're very successful with that. We tried to do it on a statewide level. But once we developed the mascot, and I handed you a little coloring book that the mascot will hand out so that kids can color their favorite retail store. And it's just a fun, good feel campaign. The other thing I learned about mascots is there is a mascot code, and a mascot cannot talk. The kids will go up to them and give them a hug and get their picture taken with them, but the mascot cannot talk because that's a mascot code.
Well, we've never heard Sparty talk, have we?
That's right.
It's interesting to me, though, that the retail scene is changing so rapidly, and I think most of us would like to buy local. I mean, if we had our druthers, but the competition from certainly online shoppers, shopping opportunities is tremendous. But what I'm finding more and more is that local retailers are willing to compete on prices with, you know, online sites.
They have to in order to survive. And, you know, consumers are really very fortunate. They have such a wide variety of shopping venues. And the internet certainly has its place. Sometimes goods cannot be found locally, and then the internet comes into play. But unfortunately, the internet sellers are not reinvesting in Michigan. So we're asking people to think before they click the button to try to keep dollars in the mitten when at all possible.
And one of the persons who'd like to have those dollars is Celeste Holmes, who Celeste Saltzman, owner of Retail Therapy in Old Town. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Glad you're here. So you've just moved from, well, recently moved from Okemos to Old Town.
Right.
A bold move on your part, but certainly an investment by a local business in opportunity in Old Town and shopping there. So how's it going?
It's going fabulously. Within the first month, we had doubled our sales from the previous year. So, and then every month after that, it's been the same or more.
So the Buy Near Buy campaign certainly would be valuable to you.
Oh, definitely. I mean, we can offer so many things that big box stores can't offer or online shopping can't offer.
Mm-hmm. How will you promote this? I mean, do you have signs in your window or do you tell your customers to remind them to tell their friends or what are you doing?
Well, mostly it's just we give great customer service.
Mm-hmm.
So that encourages people to come back. And what I do, and the name says it all, is that we're shopping, but it's also like a little bit of therapy because we really make women feel good about themselves. And so when they leave our store, they have something that's unique, that's well suited for them and their age. And also we try to source out a lot of U.S. made goods. So it's not just buying local, but it's also buying in the States.
I mean, clearly this is a strategy that your company or your business uses to separate yourself from, well, larger stores and
well,
the big
exactly.
box retailers, perhaps.
Well, when I first started retail therapy, I had to say to myself, how am I going to make myself different? How am I going to compete against those big box stores? So I put this plan together that we were going to try and find smaller U.S.-made companies, little boutique-driven companies, that we were going to carry a small quantity of each thing so that women wouldn't see themselves coming and going at an event because I didn't have that many pieces of each style, and that we were going to really give the woman a lot of care and attention. And we also, we have a lot of people that do alterations because we really tweak the garment to fit them correctly. You don't get that in the big box stores.
You know, Jim, Celeste talks about, she has a particular strategy. And when you talk to your smaller businesses particular, do you help them with this?
Oh, absolutely. We do provide promotional materials that they can display in their window to remind people to buy nearby. We provide economic analysis to show the value of it. We're doing something fun this weekend that any consumer can post a buying local using the hashtag #IBuyNearby and put it on social media, and then randomly we'll pick one picture and that person will receive $500 in a gift certificate to purchase. So we try to give retailers the tools. We try to do what we're doing today, talking about the importance of buying nearby, keeping dollars in the mitten.
Mm-hmm. Are you growing? Is the retail, what's the health of the retail industry in the state?
It certainly struggled when the world fell apart in 07 and 08, and it is coming back very, very nicely. Michigan is certainly on the comeback state, as is retail. And niche retailers you've got to figure out what your market strategy is, what your product selection is. And those that have figured that out are doing very well.
Well, it's very interesting. We hope this campaign works well. I think it's a good reminder to folks that, you know, local retailing really matters, and there's some excellent deals and values in that. Hey, we'd like to thank our guests, CEO of the Michigan Retailers Association, Jim Hallin, and Celeste Saltzman, owner of Retail Therapy in Old Town. Thank you so much for being here, and good luck with the campaign.
Thanks,
thank
Mindy.
You.
Bye nearby.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Coming up on Current State, on Sunday we learned that former MSU defensive back Mylon Hicks lost his life in a shocking the entire Spartan family. And on the same day, we also learned of the death of Miami Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez and, of course, golf icon Arnold Palmer. Current Sports host Al Martin will join us soon to help make sense of these goodbyes. We'll also chat with Al about Michigan State's loss on Saturday and the Lions losing on Sunday, two teams that causing their fans some real doubts about the direction of the rest of the season. All that coming up later this hour on Current State. Welcome back to Current State on WKAR 90.5 FM. I'm Mickey Hurton from Lansing City Pulse, filling in for Mark Bayshore. Hey, in case you haven't heard, our next Pop-Up Stories live storytelling event is this Thursday, September 29th. It's going to be at the Reach Studio Arts Center, 6 p.m., and our own Current State producer and Morning Edition host, Brooke Allen, will be the host. Our theme this time around is turning over a new leaf, so come on out and hear some great stories. And if you're inspired by the theme and you have a story to tell on your own, we still have room for storytellers, so email us at currentstate@wkar.org to sign up. Now, this is the last pop-up stories of the year, so be sure not to miss it. You're listening to Current State on WKAR. I'm Mickey Hurton. And now it's time for another pop-up story. The theme of our August pop-up was Into the Wild. Storyteller Megan McMahon told a story of being surrounded by wildlife of all kind where she lives.
Well, normally I'm a very unlucky person, but I did happen to fall into good luck when I bought the property I have now, which is at the dead end of a dirt road. And finally, my wildlife degree came in handy because I can at least manage that little piece of property. So I manage it for wildlife diversity, and I sit at my window with my camera and I take pictures, or I'll put my blind out on the porch like a good redneck does and take pictures out there of the birds and the herds of deer that come up, the turkeys. And this year I've had a large group of raccoons. Now I know everybody's had a lot of raccoons and possums this year in particular. But I'm looking out my window one day, and I'm feeding the birds, and they're all different colors, like 10 different species swooping in and out and feeding each other or fighting each other. And then this beautiful red deer comes up, glorious coat that's shiny, and she's prancing. And I look down, and there's a raccoon at her feet. They're all eating the bird feed, and I look back, and I go, I'm in a Disney movie. And I sit back and going, I'm a princess. And my friends asked me, well, what's your princess name? I thought, well, it's Princess Meg. But anyway, so each day I'd go get home and I'd get my camera and I'd look at these, and gradually I was working myself outside to take more and more pictures, and I could get closer and closer. And of course, at first the deer had gone off now to eat the horse food. So she's out in the pasture. But the raccoon's still coming up because they like that expensive bird seed. And I think, oh, okay, I can get more. And at first, I had to name them, too. Let me go back a bit. And so I named since this was a Disney movie, the red deer is named Ariel, and the raccoon is Walt. So now Walt's coming up and eating this, and he'll run off into the tall grass when I first come out and then stand up like this, and I go, you're not a meerkat, you're a raccoon. And he'd run away a little bit more. And we do this, and gradually he stopped running away. And at this point, I want to be very careful that I'm not making friends with the raccoon because they're wildlife. I don't want to feed them on purpose. I don't advocate wildlife as pets in any form. So at the end of taking the pictures, I'd wave my arms and yell, shoo, shoo, go away. And Walt would either run off or run up a tree. Well, the times he'd run up the tree, he'd be like this with his arms around it, his head behind it. And I'd go, I can see you, Walt. And he'd go out like this, and then back. I go, Walt, I can still see you. Your tail's a dead giveaway. Like this. And so I'd walk back in the house after yelling and waving my hands. Well, then it got a little further along, and other raccoon friends starting showing up, too. Walt apparently had a similarly sized brother, which I named Ray, of course, because that's Walt's brother. And then this big brown raccoon showed up, and I thought, well, that's got to be Walt's wife, Lillian. So they're all coming, and Lillian's clearly in charge, but, you know, women are. And so she gets first crack at the food and gets to hiss away at the others. And one of these times I went out, Lillian trotted off, Walt climbs up the tree, and then is just hanging there like this when I realize, oh, Walt is not a Walt. Walt has recently had kits. So I thought, well, raccoons don't care. I'm still calling her Walt. So a few days later, I see the offspring of Walt. I'm looking out, and there in my platform bird feeder is Walt holding on to the edge, going like this, swinging one of the cubs in the bird feeder as it's eating away and helping the other one get up in there. And I've got a good-sized lens, so I can get, you know, pretty close pictures. And I'm taking these pictures, and Walt's fine with it. He's like, oh, it's just you. But the young ones are a little nervous, so Walt climbs down, and I had to name the two young little ones, and Pluto comes down calmly after Walt is eating alongside, but then the one that had to be named Goofy is scrambling up and down, running up and down, I can't figure it out, launches off the pad and lands. In the meantime, I'm getting more and more worried about all this money I'm spending on seed, and I walk past my barn, and there's Lillian sitting on the bird seed bin, and I think she's got her paw stuck in it. And I realized, no, she's smashed her paw through it and is just sitting there like this, kind of looking at me like, do we really have to do this? You're going to yell at me. I'm going to scamper away. And I go, scamper? And she goes, I'm big boned. So she goes, and then I'm just going to come back. So she scampers off. I go and lock up the barns. I'm walking past, and I see her back there, sitting there, and she goes, oh, and your fake dog barks are really embarrassing. So, okay. So I've started now. I thought, this is enough. The young are showing up. I eventually have 13 raccoons, this sea of raccoons romping around my front yard, and I have to let the dog out. And luckily, it's a dog that has a good recall, so I say, leave it, and he goes, oh, chicken food. Runs off, and the raccoons scurry away. Now we're back to the point where the raccoons are no longer showing up. All of a sudden, they're just gone. And I haven't heard the coyotes, so I know it's time for the families to go their own separate ways and for me to remember that was a nice little anthropomorphic story in my head, but they're still wild animals, and they still have plenty of good habitat out there for them.
Don't forget, our next pop-up stories is coming up this Thursday at the Reach Arts Studio Arts Center in Old Town. It's the latest one of the year, so we hope you'll make it. Come out, hear some great stories. Well, life is always uncertain, and yesterday the Michigan State community, as well as the entire sports world, was reminded of that. Former Detroit Renaissance High and Michigan State defensive back Mylon Hicks was the victim of a nightclub shooting in Canada over the weekend. The second Spartan football player that died this year, former punter Mike Sandler, who was inducted into the Michigan State Hall of Fame, died this summer, victim of a car accident. And news also broke yesterday about the passing of Miami Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez, as well as the passing of golf icon Arnold Palmer. To put some of this emotional weekend into perspective, we'll chat about the weekend losses also of the Lions and Michigan State football Spartans. We invite our current sports host, Al Martin, and Scott Pohl to talk about the week of sports.
Hi, Mickey.
Gentlemen.
What's up, Mickey?
Well, so what's been the reaction around the Spartan Nation to the death of Hicks, and what did MSU coach Mark D'Antonio have to say about that?
Yeah, when it comes to Hicks, Mickey, just first off, shock and sadness. I mean, as you just stated, I mean, you know, this is a football community that now loses two individuals in the same year. Of course, with the passing of Mike Sadler, former MSU punter, who was actually inducted into the MSU Athletics Hall of Fame this past weekend, and now you get news about Mylon Hicks. Mylon It's interesting because I have a lot of friends, because I graduated MSU in 2012. Yeah. Milan came to Michigan State that year. Was 2010. So mm-hmm. I was a sophomore when he came to Michigan State as a freshman. And he was a letter winner from 2012 to 2014. So I knew of Milan. I mean, I would go out to social gatherings and would see him there. I had a lot of friends that knew Milan.
And what was he like?
Good guy. It's interesting because anytime you talk about Milan Hicks to those who really knew him, just a friendly personality who got along with everybody, just a down-to-earth guy. My interactions were always fun. And a good friend of mine, I mean, they were kind of like brother and sister when they were at Michigan State. I mean, just completely tore up about it. She posted videos of the two throughout her social media pages saying, I can't believe it. There were tributes from my friends who went to Michigan State with Milan. I mean, there were tributes throughout the entire day. And it's just shocking. I mean, we're talking about a young man with, his future wide ahead of him. And, you know, you wake up to news like that. And Mark D'Antonio, he made a statement on Milan Hicks's death, and he went on to say, just to read a quick excerpt here, quote, he went 100 miles an hour. Number six was a beautiful person and just lit a room up when he walked in. He established himself as a leader on our football team in his last year. This is just tragic and has rocked our Spartan football community. So this is a guy who played corner, safety, and linebacker for Michigan State and also won the award for most inspirational player at the team banquet in 2014.
Yeah, it's just awful. Scott, thoughts on this?
Well, I was going to ask Al if you've heard, maybe it's too early to have heard the kind of thing that I'm about to ask you about, and that is the reaction the program might have in comparison to Mike Sadler's death, because we've seen the big tributes at football games, the number three added to the Spartan logo at the middle of the field.
Right.
It'll be interesting over the next few weeks to see how the Spartan football program responds and whether, I don't know, maybe they'll add the number six to the number three at midfield. They may have other ways of paying tribute. Have you heard anything at this early stage as to whether the program will respond in that kind of way?
Nothing as of yet. I think everyone is still trying to digest the news, but I'm sure that the question will be posed to head coach Mark D'Antonio during tomorrow's weekly press conference about how the program plans on giving a tribute to Milan Hicks. But it's early right now, but I would assume in some way, shape, or form, they will also decide to honor Milan in some fashion. We just don't know just yet. But just tough stuff, though. I mean, both Sadler and Hicks now gone. Crazy.
Well, and then we have Jose Fernandez. I mean, you looked at those pictures on the rocks of the boat, and I felt like I was watching some kind of movie. I mean, the scene from a Bourne movie or James Bond. It was just been awful. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, another one that no one saw coming. I mean, Jose Fernandez, a young kid in his early 20s, who just had a promising baseball career in front of him. I mean, 2011, first-round pick, taken 14th overall by the Marlins, 16-8 on the year, fantastic ERA, won the National League Rookie of the Year in 2013, actually announced last week that his girlfriend was pregnant in the ball club. The Marlins announced yesterday that he was supposed to have he's going to have a baby girl. Again, future wide ahead of him, and then something like this happens. Just stunning, really stunning. And, you know, all the tributes that have come in concerning the death of Jose Fernandez have been just really touching.
Well, you know, Scott, when you think about it, these are young people, mm-hmm. young players with their lives ahead of them, and you and I are a little more seasoned, let's put it that way. You think about the death of Arnold Palmer, and really that's more celebratory, isn't it?
Well, you know, Arnold Palmer, I posted, I believe, on your thread yesterday on Facebook, Al, that modern-day golf is what it is because of Arnold Palmer, that his rise in popularity on television in the 60s is why golf became a commodity on television, and Arnie's army following him everywhere. You know, many people have said that golfers cash big checks these days because of Tiger Woods and what he brought to the game, and there's a lot of truth in that. Mm. But Tiger Woods cashed some big checks because of Arnold Palmer. I think it all goes back to Arnold Palmer and how golf rose on television largely because of his popularity.
Certainly, and I have to agree with that. I think there's levels to notoriety in sports or any realm for that matter. And, you know, you hear the word legend thrown around a lot when it comes to those who have made an indelible mark in sports. And for me, Arnold Palmer was more than a legend. He was an icon. I mean, when you hear the word, you know, the name, excuse me, Arnold Palmer, there's so many things that come to mind. And you talk about the mark he made on the game of golf, Scott. No one matches it, at least right now.
I don't think any golfers had endorsements before he did.
He's got his own drink. Yeah. Okay, I mean, come on. Well, how many sports icons that have their own drink, right?
That's right.
I mean, unbelievable.
But a reputation never tarnished. I mean, he always seemed to have a very pleasant, professional, and I mean, if you didn't follow golf, he seemed like a really good guy.
There was a remark on NPR this morning about how when he signed autographs, he took the extra moment to make it legible,
mm-hmm.
because you know, so many athletes just a scratch when they sign an autograph. He wanted it to be legible so that the people would remember years later that it was from Arnold Palmer.
How cool is that, right?
It meant a great deal to him that people would remember him in that kind of way.
Did you ever see him play? I mean, you were a Masters guy. You've gone to those tournaments.
Well, I went to a practice round a few years ago. Arnold Palmer was not there the day that I happened to be there. No, I never saw him play in person. I have a high school friend who was quite a golfer who has pictures with Arnold Palmer that I've been seeing on Facebook the last couple of days.
Wow.
Well, let's move from one grim story to another. MSU's weekend, I mean, they were supposed to win this game, and they just got stomped.
Yeah, how tough was that to watch, right? I don't think anybody saw that coming. First off, a 36 win for Wisconsin at Spartan Stadium. Maybe the other way around is what, you know, a few people may have predicted. But no one saw a blowout in favor of Wisconsin on Saturday afternoon at Spartan Stadium. And there's so many layers to try and pick apart when it comes to why Michigan State struggled, Mickey. But I think right now, I think the talk of the town throughout this entire week leading up to, you know, this game against Indiana this weekend on the road is the whole quarterback situation. You know, Tyler O'Connor was not great on Saturday, and he has not been accurate this entire year. He was 18 of 38. He threw three interceptions, 224 yards, no touchdowns, and we saw that he wasn't even in the game in the waning moments of that fourth quarter. Mark D'Antonio brought out Brian Lewerke. But Tyler O'Connor had so many overthrows, underthrows, just inaccurate throws the entire afternoon, and that really hurt that Michigan State offense. And then on the defensive end, first off, they start off without their defensive leader in Riley Bulla, who we're still trying to figure out why he was hurt in that game. There was no push from the defensive line. Alex Hornibrook, a guy who's coming into a hostile environment, his first start in conference play. You have to go against the defending conference champs. Hornibrook looked comfortable. He looked like the senior. I mean, this is a redshirt freshman. He looked like the senior in opposition in comparison to Tyler O'Connor, right? And a lot of it has to do with no push off the defensive line. He was comfortable in the pocket. And that secondary giving up way too many third down conversions. It was really mind-boggling for me, Scott.
Did you think they came out flat?
I did.
You don't see a Mark D'Antonio team come out flat.
I thought
like
that first running play was great.
Mm-hmm.
They got, I think they got 19 yards on that. I said, oh boy, they are pumped. And then the air came out of that balloon so fast.
Mm-hmm. Right. I do think they came out flat. And that's something that I asked Demetrius Cox, you know, right after the game. And he said, you know, he kind of brushed it off saying, yeah, well, you know, we'll be all right. You know,
yes,
we still
got.
Exactly. They kind of just, you know, brushed it aside. But, you know, they're coming off a great win against Notre Dame. A win in which, yeah, they did let Notre Dame back in the door, but a great win nonetheless under the lights. Maybe they kind of overlooked Wisconsin. You know, maybe they came out with the mindset, okay, this is Wisconsin. We should be able to win this. We're favored in this game. Who knows? But at the end of the day, there are still consistent problems, consistent holes in the boat that have not been plugged just yet.
Hey, we're running out of time. The Lions?
Oh, boy. Do we have to make
it? Is there any good news?
We said the same thing. Yeah. Do we have to go there, right?
Yeah.
The Detroit Lions, I mean, where do we start with that one? But I will say this, though. Did any of us really expect them to beat the Green Bay Packers? I surely didn't have them beating the Green Bay Packers. And they did make it a game later on as the offense started to get some sort of consistency. Marvin Jones Jr., a fantastic wide receiver for the Honolulu Blue. I think I see why the Lions dumped a lot of money into acquiring him with the absence of Calvin Johnson. I love Marvin Jones Jr., but that run game, when you make the Lions one-dimensional offensively, they struggle, and that's exactly what the Packers were able to do on Sunday.
I thought the Packers might have taken the foot off the gas like Michigan State did at Notre Dame.
Possibly, yeah. I think so, yeah.
Could happen. Hey, listen, we're here with current sports host Al Martin, Scott Pohl. Thank you, gentlemen.
Sure.
We'll talk about sports again next week.
All right, thank you, Mickey.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, What's happening when Elvis Aaron Presley meets Teddy Roosevelt? It's the premiere of a play coming to Ann Arbor this weekend as part of U of M's University Musical Society season. We'll speak to two actresses. Yes, actresses who portray Elvis and Teddy in the play Roosevelt's. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Warr. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast is your informative, insightful, and indispensable connection with what's happening around mid-Michigan and beyond. From politics to education, environment, news, healthcare, science, tech, music, and theater, stories from around the state, it's all there, all about your hometown. That's our Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime, at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. And that's it for Current State. Have a good day.